Dr. Sethupathi received his undergraduate degree in computer science at Cornell University, and he went on to do his PhD in PIN in computational biology and genomics. He then completed a postdoc with Dr. Francis Collins. Francis Collins, you might recall, is the gentleman who led the endeavor to decode human DNA many years ago. At the time that Dr. Sethupathi did his postdoc, he was the head of the Human Genome Research Institute. He's now the director of the National Institutes of Health. It's a big deal. Dr. Sethupathi currently serves as assistant professor of genetics at UNC Chapel Hill, where he researches microRNAs. Surveying his publication record on Google Scholar, I noticed several publications in Nature and Science, so apparently his microRNA game is quite strong. Tonight, he will speak to us about science, faith, and the search for identity. Please give your attention to Dr. Praveen Sethupathi.
Everybody hear me okay? Great. Thank you all for coming. This is a packed house, and it's really a neat opportunity for me. And it's cliche. I feel like I'm a little close to you. If you need me to back off, let me know. And I'm also told that the field of vision for the video camera here is pretty well defined. And so if I don't veer away too much and I stick here, that's probably why. As I was saying, it's pretty cliche to say that I'm delighted to be with you all. It's sort of the obligatory way to start a lecture or a talk like this, particularly one that is invited. But I really mean it, and for three reasons. One is I'm always honored when someone says they want to hear from me on a topic and that they think it's valuable to hear about and to discuss. And so I appreciate Glenn and the Veritas Forum, as well as any of the Chi Alpha student leaders that may have been involved in that decision. The second is, as you heard, I did my bachelor's at Cornell. It's not where I wanted to go. Can you guess where I wanted to go? So I didn't get into Stanford. And I've been trying to convince my son, who's with me here on this trip, that Cornell is the place to be. But you just can't compete with Palm Drive. And that was my mistake. I brought him onto campus, and now he's hooked. So we'll see about that. Are we more than our genes? That's the topic for today's talk. And at the heart of this question, as Glenn said, I believe is a search for identity. And I believe that that's a pursuit that resonates with all, if not, or most, I'm sorry, if not most, all of us. So who am I? I'm a Christian, a scientist with a Hindu background, Indian ancestry, Canadian birth, and American citizenship. Right? So that's a lot to unpack. But given today's topic, I'd like to start with who I am as a scientist. So I trained in computer science as an undergraduate at Cornell University. And toward the latter part of my years at Cornell, I did research in a computational neurobiology laboratory where I performed mathematical modeling of olfaction, or the sense of smell. And you and I can actually discriminate among thousands of different types of smells. And we accomplished this with the use of a highly intricate information processing network in our olfactory system. This field was very rewarding because it allowed me to see the value of interdisciplinary study, applying my mathematical and computational skills to make sense of biological phenomena. It was around this time that the field of genomics was exploding onto the scene of biomedicine because of the Human Genome Project that Glenn mentioned earlier. This was an international endeavor to determine the entire sequence of, at the time, human DNA, and it eventually spawned efforts to sequence the genomes of numerous different kinds of species. And the project was completed well in advance of the projected date, due in large part to remarkable innovations in technology and biocomputing that we've seen just in the last couple decades. It was clear that the Human Genome Project was ushering in a new era in science, where the bottleneck was no longer data generation. Instead, the main challenge, and it's the challenge that my generation and your generation are going to be facing as well, is the integrative analysis of massive amounts of data. We are collecting data at a pace that is staggering. We don't know where to keep it, where to store it, and what to do with it. Right? So motivated by this challenge, I enrolled in a PhD program in genomics and computational biology, which was rather new at the time, at the University of Pennsylvania. And after my PhD work, I joined the lab of Dr. Francis Collins at the National Institutes of Health as a postdoctoral fellow to study genomics in the context of human disease, specifically what are the signals in our genome, right, that tell us that we might be at risk for diabetes or Alzheimer's? And if we can find these signals, can we say anything about why they might be increasing our risk for those diseases? So following my stint at the NIH, I joined the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I am today, as a professor in the Department of Genetics to continue investigating genomics and human disease. And my responsibilities today are very diverse, but one of the most exciting things I get to do in my position is to cast a scientific vision, procure funding to materialize that vision, and to then assemble and lead a research team to execute that vision. And perhaps the best analogy I can use for this in terms of what I do is leading a small startup company. Recently, large international teams have collaborated to identify thousands of specific DNA mutations, or also called genetic variants, in the human population that are associated with different kinds of diseases, prostate cancer, diabetes, heart disease. And one of the most significant discoveries from these studies is that the vast majority of complex disease-associated DNA mutations or variants, they occur in regions of the genome that don't code for the genes. Instead, they contain important functional elements that regulate where and when and to what extent certain genes are going to be turned on or off. In other words, they're like switches, or maybe better yet, dials or rheostats that control gene activation. And you may have heard on the news at some point, right, that someone with a disease had the bad gene or the mutated gene. But what we now appreciate more than ever before is that many, if not most, complex disease-associated DNA variants are not in regions that alter the gene itself, but rather in these switch regions, in these dial regions, that control how much or where and at what time genes are turned on. And my lab at UNC essentially is interested in finding out where all of these regulatory switches or dials are and figuring out which ones are most important in what diseases. Okay? So to accomplish this, we've taken advantage of recent progress in a field called epigenomics. So some of you may be familiar that the prefix epi is Greek and it means above or beyond. So epigenomics refers to a set of mechanisms that are beyond the DNA that control DNA function. So how does that work? Well, let's consider our DNA for a minute, okay? Those of you that are not geneticists, it's present in almost every individual cell in our body. And in each of those cells, it's comprised of about 3 billion nucleotide pairs in the kind of classical double helix model that probably most of you are familiar with. If you took the DNA from all of the cells in a body and stretched it out end to end, it would be hundreds of millions of miles, just from one of our bodies here. I have been in genetics for a while, and that never ceases to amaze me. The amount of material that is so tightly packed into our finite body. Each cell, okay, is able to make marks on the packaging material to indicate where certain important parts of the DNA are. Okay, so when the DNA is tightly wound up and packaged, there's a packaging material, and we don't need to get into the details of it except to know that you can make marks on that material to indicate where certain functional and important parts of the DNA are. For example, if you found, let's say, marks A, B, and C, it might tell you that the underlying DNA sequence has the potential to act like a regulatory switch or the dials we talked about for a particular gene. The fascinating thing about this is that environmental variables, right, like your exposure to chemicals or diet or smoking, they can change these marks and thereby entirely change the way the underlying DNA functions without actually touching the DNA sequence itself. So what this says is that your genetics doesn't completely determine who you are. Even our biology teaches us that. The environment around us shapes the packaging material of our DNA, and it directs how our DNA is going to work. So that already tells us that we are indeed more than our genes. So maybe the question we really need to ask is, are we more than our biology? Are we more than the material things, genes or otherwise, that make up our bodies? And as a biologist, I've learned three major lessons that I think help provide a framework for exploring this question further, and I'd like to share those with you today. First, biological science is very rarely about proof. Rather, it's more about accumulating evidence toward a reasonable or likely explanation. Okay, so one is usually collecting diverse kinds of data and making inferences based on that data. Now, don't get me wrong, there's certainly a logic that guides your inferences, but it's often more imprecise than people realize. Science is actually a lot like detective work. It's probably the best analogy I can provide for what I do. Think of what a detective does, all right? He or she is faced with a crime and essentially has to reconstruct the course of events that led to that crime. Obviously, there are many possibilities at first, and so the job of the detective is to gather information and make a case for the most likely possibility. Oftentimes, the case is so strong, like on CSI, right, that it feels like a proof. But it isn't really, it's just a far more compelling than any other explanation. And it's sometimes, or oftentimes, the same way in biology. In fact, we are often exploring things we can't directly see and can't directly measure. Even questions like how deep is the ocean floor is actually far more complicated than it seems, and our answers are based on accumulation of evidence from a collection of various kinds of data, making inferences about those, leading to follow-up tests, and oftentimes not direct observation, because we're unable to do so, for example. So as a scientist, right, I'm faced with a particular unexplained biological phenomenon, and essentially I have to uncover the hidden mechanisms by which it occurs. This is a lot more like messy detective work than anything else. And in fact, it's what I find so fun about what I do, and it's partially why I do what I do. You know, consider the theory of common descent, which proposes an evolutionary model for biological life, that all living organisms share a common ancestor. I, together with the vast majority of biologists, are proponents of common descent. But the reason for this, we have to be clear, is that it's not because we can provide proof, because what would that entail? It would entail going back in time and watching history unfold, I suppose, in warp speed, right? And until one of you techies at Stanford comes up with the ability to do that, we're stuck, okay? So rather, it's because of the accumulation of diverse types of supporting evidence through painstaking and careful work over several centuries that, taken together, challenge the plausibility of other explanatory models, right? So when Charles Darwin originally proposed his ideas and his theory, and he wrote his treatise, The Origin of Species, it was mostly scientists at first that were most vocal about their skepticism. In fact, Asa Gray, a renowned Christian at the time at Princeton Theological Seminary, which at the time was far more conservative than it is today, okay, was one of the original supporters of The Origin of Species and strongly encouraged Darwin to send it overseas to America so that he could distribute it for people to see how incredible the work of the Lord is. A lot has changed in the way that that discussion happens today in our country. It took decades of research for scientists to begin to build consensus around an idea that they originally had much skepticism about. And so that brings me to the second lesson I've learned in biology, and that is that biological science is constantly self-correcting and almost never closes the door on a possibility even if it defies present assumptions. And a prominent example in my field of genomics is the concept of junk DNA. Some of you may have heard about it. Prior to the genome era, the prevailing wisdom among scientists was that substantive portions of the genome were likely non-functional. Later on, many of the same scientists eventually produced the evidence demonstrating that this was patently false. No matter how tightly held the view of junk DNA in the field, there was still an openness in the scientific community to the possibility that it wasn't junk. And it was this openness that led to new evidence, dismantling of misconceptions, and ultimately scientific advancement. For this reason, universal negatives are very rarely issued in biology, and if they are, we should be wary. Even the vocal atheist Richard Dawkins accepted that as a scientist, he must concede that there could be something incredibly grand and incomprehensible and beyond our present understanding. Now, I don't want to misrepresent Richard's position here. He certainly doesn't believe in a higher power. But my point here is that as a scientist, he's compelled to concede the possibility, however unlikely he may ultimately believe it to be. Finally, the third lesson is that some questions that have arisen from work in biology cannot really be addressed by the tools we have in biology. And we have to be honest about that as scientists as well. For example, at some point during the study of genetics, the question will inevitably arise, why did life forms originate in the first place? And that's a very natural question to ask. Many have asked it, even if they don't want it to be known that they have, right? And we're free to speculate, but science is not equipped to answer that kind of question. Using science to answer questions like that is a bit like using colors to describe the relationship between numbers. Colors and numbers are both true and useful concepts, but one is not a very useful way of thinking or describing the other. This doesn't by itself mean that there is an answer somewhere else. It doesn't automatically imply that. It just means that we have to be faithful to what science is and what it isn't. And we can't extend the purview of science beyond what it is capable of addressing. And I fear that this happens increasingly, and we need to be careful about that. So how do these lessons inform our pursuit of the answer to the question, are we more than our biology? I believe that they free us from the commonly held and often propagated view that science categorically disproves the supernatural, or even that science as we know it is the sole arbiter of truth. In fact, science, truly considered, is agnostic with respect to anything outside of the natural realm. It neither accepts it, right, nor can it refute it. Therefore, the important point here is that science does not constrain us to look only to science in our search for identity. That's the punchline here, right? And it may seem obvious to some of you in the room, but this is actually a critical point that we're struggling with as a nation. Science does not actually constrain us to look only to it in our search for identity and truth. It doesn't point to anything else necessarily, but it doesn't constrain us either. And that's an important point for us to make because it can be liberating. So what else might define who we are? What might define who I am? Maybe my name is a good starting point. Okay, I don't think there's anybody else here in the room named Praveen, but Stanford, it's pretty eclectic, maybe I'm wrong. My name is Praveen Sethapathy and it is of Sanskrit origin, and Praveen means skillful. Sethapathy means Lord of the Bridge, and the bridge refers to the former chain of limestone shoals that connected the southern tip of India to the northern coast of Sri Lanka. And according to the ancient Hindu epic, the Ramayana, the bridge was constructed by Lord Rama and his army. And so needless to say, my name is steeped in ancient Indian tradition and Hindu lore. My Indian heritage is a part of who I am. I was raised as a Hindu for 18 years, and I very much appreciated Hinduism as a rich culture to enjoy. But it wasn't until my college years that I realized I didn't really know much about Hinduism as a belief system to live by. Right? And those are two different things. And that's something we're increasingly engaging in the Christian community as well. Right? A rich culture to enjoy versus a belief system to be devoted to. I had gone through the motions of various aspects of Hinduism, and I was familiar with many of the traditions and the stories of the faith, but I realized that I had no idea what Hinduism or religion in general really meant to me personally. I hadn't really stopped to think about it until my freshman, sophomore year at Cornell. And I became intrigued at one point when a friend introduced me to the Christian Bible, and as I was reading it, I became intrigued by how it compared to other religions. And so over the course of several years, I attempted to read the scriptures from many different faith traditions, sort of setting up a comparative religion course for myself. And so I would read texts from Hinduism, and Buddhism, and Islam. And so people often ask me at this point, what was it that stood out to you in Christianity? And as cliche as it may sound, it was meeting the person of Jesus. He's the supposed hero of the story. Okay, many of you that are here in the room that are Christians, think back, if you have a moment like this, to when you were first starting to really understand the person and the character of Jesus. I'll never forget that moment for me, because he's the supposed hero of this story, and yet he appears as a naked, disfigured, and pathetic man dying on a cross. It wasn't the superhero Rama or Krishna that I was used to reading about in Hinduism and that I so enjoyed, or even the valiant Muhammad, who I eventually spent some time studying. But one of the things that I would learn, one of the first things I would learn in my study of Scripture, is that in the cross, Jesus was turning upside down my notions of power. He wasn't on the cross, it turned out, because he was powerless to stop it. He was on the cross because that's how far he'd go to exercise his power to fix a broken world, to make things new. See, you and I, okay, or maybe I'll just limit it to myself, all right? We exercise power by forcing our authority or our perceived superiority on the world, on the others around us. But Jesus exercised his power by laying his life down before the world. We get so used to talking about it and singing about it, but I think it's really important to just internalize that reality on a regular basis. He chose to use his power, far greater than ours, to lay his life down. In other words, he was choosing to use his power completely for the benefit of others and not himself. I had never read anything like that before. It was truly radical. It didn't make me a Christian, but it intrigued the heck out of me. And it made me want to deepen my knowledge of this person who was so unlike anyone else I had ever encountered in life or in literature. So at some point, I became involved in evaluating the various claims of the gospel accounts. And the first question was, what is the evidence that Jesus really even existed? Right? In scientific research, we are trained to go to great lengths to design experiments in a way that reduce bias as much as possible. That is, we aim to avoid or at least account for tendencies in the experimental setup that encourage one result over another. I think I must have had this impulse even at an early years because it was critical for me at that time of study to examine the evidence for the historicity of Christ outside of the Bible, which of course I viewed as a biased source. And I was surprised to find that several non-Christian ancient historians had recorded events about Jesus. And so I looked into it further. One example is the writings of Josephus, a first century Jewish scholar and historian. His works include multiple references not only to Jesus, but also to several of the other characters that are central to the biblical account of Jesus' life, including John the Baptist and Herod the Great and Pontius Pilate. Now, to be clear, this is not bias-free. For example, there is some evidence, pretty good evidence actually, to suggest that the texts of Josephus may have been contaminated over time with a little bit of Christian interpolation. Meaning, there could have been some kind of tampering with the text, possibly even the injection of references to Jesus that weren't originally there. But what one learns upon digging further is that the writings of Josephus and other historians have actually been subject to very meticulous language analysis by Christians and non-Christians alike. And the broad consensus among numerous Christian and non-Christian scholars is that when you strip away anything that could be perceived to be inauthentic, what you're still left with includes direct references to Jesus and his contemporaries. The first century Roman historian, Tacitus, also specifically mentions Jesus, as well as his crucifixion and the Roman persecution of the early Christians. What's really interesting about Tacitus is that he writes in a way that is clearly derogatory toward Jesus and his followers. So it takes quite a bit of mental gymnastics, actually, to imagine that this text also was the product solely of Christian interpolation and tampering. And it isn't just Josephus and Tacitus. There are other examples, of course. But let's be fair, okay? Analyses of ancient texts are interesting, but they're fraught with all sorts of challenges. And none of this extra-biblical documentation was necessarily slam-dunk evidence to me. But the point is that it certainly was much more than I would have expected, maybe even secretly hoping to find, if Jesus was merely a legend, a later fabrication of creative minds. Now, it's one thing to examine whether Jesus was a real historical figure, and it's quite another to examine whether he really was resurrected. And this matters a whole lot, because the resurrection is central to the Christian faith. In fact, Christianity actually rises or falls on the validity of the resurrection. These are from the words of Paul. To examine the resurrection claim, I focused largely on the biblical narrative itself. And in retrospect, this is not unlike what I do as a scientist sometimes when I evaluate the validity of the claims in any given scientific paper. That is, I look for clues in the description of the experiments and data that help me evaluate the reliability of the overall conclusions. In doing this, I was struck by several features of the biblical account of the resurrection. We can maybe get to that in Q&A, but in the interest of getting back to the main point of today's talk, I won't go into all of these now. But suffice to say, the task at hand for me at the time was to determine the model or the explanation that fit the data the best. And this is by nature an inexact process, but it is often what we do in science as well. So why was all this examination so important to do, and why am I taking all this time telling you about it tonight? The first reason is that stripped of Christ, Christianity was no more or less compelling to me than any other faith tradition. It was the person of Jesus that made all the difference to me. And so it was vital to me that I examine the claims of his historicity. The second reason, and this is the one that I think is the most germane to today's topic, is that if Jesus is who he said he was, then I have to ask, what did he have to say about our collective search for identity? Well, he says that we find our true and ultimate identity in him. This is perhaps best encapsulated in Paul's statement in the book of Galatians, that it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. This doesn't mean that we lose our individuality. What it conveys is that we have a spiritual nature that Christ wants to mold and transform, and that it is not entirely captured by the material substance of our body. This is a belief. All right? It is not testable or set forth by science. And as such, I understand it can be unnerving, right? I've been there. But it is something that is established in my life ultimately as part of a relationship. That too is something we often say as Christians. But let's take the time sometimes to think about what that really means and how remarkable that really is. I want to emphasize here that my various examinations of the historicity of Christ and other claims of the Bible, they did not bring me to full faith in and of themselves, as much as they broke down barriers that might have prevented me from considering the possibility of a deeper spiritual reality. And that's why I'm taking the time to talk to you about it tonight, breaking down those barriers that sometimes we're not even aware have been put up in our lives. You know, when I started following Jesus and finding my identity in him, it was also a very confusing time for my family. You know, was I rejecting my Indian culture? Would I change my name? Right? Would I suddenly become John, maybe Peter? Well, you know, their confusion was not unfounded because many before me in a similar position had done exactly that. In fact, in some communities in India, this happened very regularly. But Christ did not come to change names or to move people from one culture to another. Right? He came to renew hearts and minds and to bring life where there was death. So it was my joy to share with my family that I would remain Praveen Sethupathi, that Christ was laying a claim on my heart, not on my name. I explained that becoming Christian had nothing to do with rejecting my Indian heritage or being called by a different name. In fact, as a Christian, I found myself embracing my heritage and my name more than ever before. Rather, it was about redeeming my spiritual identity. Christ was filling me with a renewed sense of purpose, a commitment to others above myself, and a passion for justice. And as a follower of Christ today, I have a very high view of Scripture. To me, having a high view means that I strive to understand and respect both what the Bible is and what it isn't. You know, the Bible's primary objective is not to describe the mathematical language or the physical laws or the chemical makeup of the world. Your textbooks are probably a better idea for that. Right? Its goal is entirely different. It doesn't mean that God is not the author of those things, but I think the Bible is principally about speaking of God's interwoven presence in the history of mankind. His love for us, our need for him, eternity, sin, redemption, and restoration. And the Bible communicates these things in diverse ways. And this has been appreciated from early rabbinical literature to early church fathers, to leaders in the church today. right? In through prose and poetry, song, parables, polemics, rhetoric, observational language, whatever way will help us to best understand who God is, what he has done for us, and why. You know, treating the Bible as a scientific text is, sometimes I feel like it's a robot reading Romeo and Juliet, right? The true meaning and effect will be missed. So if we don't humbly and prayerfully strive to understand the richness of the language and the breadth and depth of its intended meaning, then I think we will be in danger of not only limiting the power of God and his word in our lives, but also maybe committing injustice in the name of God. When you consider the case of the church's reaction to Galileo's supporting evidence that the sun and not the earth is at the center of our solar system, right? He was branded a heretic for his scientific views, in part because they were perceived to be in conflict with scripture verses that we now appreciate are clearly intended to be poetic and figurative. And so we have to ask ourselves whether we are making any similar mistakes today. This is not in an effort to dilute our faith. It's an effort to be honest about what the Bible is and what it isn't. Because a high view of scripture respects both. I've shared with you today how genetics, environment, culture, and Christ, front and center, have shaped who I am. And hopefully I've inspired you to honestly engage some provocative but rewarding questions if you're not already. Right? So what is the purview of science really, and is it really the only path to knowledge? How does the notion of a God affect how you think about yourself? Who is Christ? How does he stand out among the pantheon of, well, I would admittedly say, are very interesting religious figures in history? In what ways are we conflating cultural traditions with scriptural teachings? These are valuable questions for every single one of us to ask. Scientists, non-scientists, Christians, non-Christians, those with a faith-based worldview, those without any faith at all. And don't take my word for the things that I've said today. Right? I encourage you to do your own detective work. And don't be afraid to do it, because there's nothing to lose, honestly. And at the very least, you may learn something about yourself, and if there really is a God who made you, then there's everything to gain, right, in your search for identity. Thank you very much. So I'm happy to take any questions that you guys have. As I emphasized earlier today in another meeting with students, I'm very informal. I'm also not easily offended. So ask me what's on your mind, if it's an honest question, and I will do my very best to address where I come from on the question. Yes?
What is your personal response to the problem with evil?
Yeah, I unfortunately don't. Yes. Thank you, Laura, for reminding me. This is a bad habit I have of not repeating the question. So the question is a very good question, is what is your personal view, I believe, on the problem of evil? I don't, unfortunately, have an abridged version. What I can say is that I've leaned very heavily on the writings of C.S. Lewis and N.T. Wright on this topic. And so for those of you that are familiar with those, that's probably where I would fall. But, you know, there are so many questions like these that I think are really important for us to wrestle with, because I think it's the process of wrestling that draws us closer to God on this, right? And maybe not the answer itself, because I don't think any of us have it. Yes?
What do you think people right now might be misinterpreting about the Bible? Any specific teachings?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are probably a lot, and I don't view any of them as malicious. I don't view any of them as intentional. As much as it is, I mean, I think a lot of the misunderstandings that we have in the Christian community come from an honest desire to hold the scriptures in high regard, right? And we don't want to, as Christians, we don't want to dilute what it is saying, right? But in an effort to do so, we're dividing among one another. And I think that that's what's really problematic. And so, you know, one that's the most immediate and easy for me to discuss, because it is very, it's one that I think about a lot, right? And that is our interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2. Many of you all probably hold diverse positions on this, or maybe not, I don't know. And my intention is not to disrespect any of your honest and thoughtful positions on this. Okay. First and foremost, I'm not a, you know, I hold the position of evolutionary creationism, but I'm not an evangelist for that, right? As much as I am an evangelist, if you want to say, for civil discourse about this topic, because we're having very little of that in our country. And I mean our country, because this is not really an issue in most of the rest of the world. But N.T. Wright has spoken very eloquently on how he's gotten into the debate because he's now seeing that we're exporting this problem. And by problem, he doesn't mean specifically a specific interpretation, but he means the manner in which we are having this conversation by saying, what you hold on Genesis 1 and 2 is gonna allow me to say whether you're a Christian or not. A whole lot of that is happening, right? People have labeled me not a Christian on the basis of my view of evolutionary creationism. But I do think that it's important for those of us that are young, and I put myself in that camp, okay, to appreciate the history behind the interpretations of Genesis 1 and 2. If you go back to early rabbinical literature, there are very nuanced positions. Early church fathers have very nuanced positions. This kind of interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2 as being, maybe something other than a literal seven-day creation, is not a movement that is recent in order to be concordist with science. It's being pitted that way, but it's not that way at all. And in reality, people have been interpreting in the Jewish tradition and in Christian tradition. Right? People have been interpreting Genesis 1 and 2 in very, very diverse, nuanced ways. Right? John Walton has a book called The Lost World of Genesis 1. And I encourage you to check it out, not because I vouch for every single thing that's in there, but because it makes us think as Christians. And he's actually describing some very, very interesting things about what Genesis 1 and 2 are really teaching us. And it turns out, these are things that are part of ancient Jewish tradition. These are not things John came up with in some harebrained scheme. He's just making it accessible for those of us who maybe aren't aware. So I think that's one area where we have to be really cautious. Of course, many of you may also experience in your home churches or maybe even in churches here, the divisions that are caused about very, very specific and narrow interpretations of things in Scripture. It doesn't mean that we should not do our homework to have our own personal belief on these things and to act out in accordance with that faith. But I think what becomes the problem is when we take what I would view as non-essential. In other words, they don't have an impact, direct impact on Jesus as the propitiation for our sins. Right? But we make those things essential, and then we divide on those things in the Christian community. It not only does a great disservice to our witness, right? But I think it's, John 17. How many times do you guys think about John 17? It says, Jesus prays, and I don't think Jesus' prayer is lip service. He prays that you and I would be one in the same way that he and the Father are one. I barely even understand how he and the Father are one. And he's calling us to be one in like manner? Right? I don't think we're caring about that enough. I don't think we're wrestling with that enough. I think we're far too easily getting angry with each other because you don't think exactly to the letter what I think. And some of those debates are important to have. It's going to be iron sharpening iron, and maybe we'll find that one is maybe it's a more faithful interpretation potentially. Those are good debates. I'm not saying we shouldn't have them, but I think we should have them in love and in respect and with an idea of shared commitment to Jesus. I think I just went somewhere totally different in that question. Sorry about that. Yes?
How is your work with microRNAs at Chapel Hill and the leadership of the National Institute of Health and Chapel Review? Have you worked with cytokines and or to microenvironments? And how is that impacting your view on life? Do you believe that's where we originally come from? And how is that impacting your faith as a Christian?
Wow, do I need to repeat that whole question? So I'll get as much of it as I remember, and maybe you can fill in the rest of it. How is your work on microRNAs? That's about as far as I got. So why?
Chapel Hill,
Yes?
Like seeding work on microRNAs, I've read a lot of papers on peanuts and floss.
Wow. Came prepared. This guy's a danger to have in class.
We did work on cytokines, which are original cell signaling molecules within the human body. Did that impact your faith at all? Because it's originally where we come from as a human being. So I would guess you look into all these good religions around the country like for now, because it's either a miserable and harsh place or you kind of had a sensibility to approach faith from a human background.
Yeah. So the question is essentially, you know, you've done all this work on microRNAs and other kinds of cellular molecules and studying cell behavior. You know, how's that impacted? Did that impact your faith?
Yeah.
And was that a primary impact on your faith other than the fact that at Cornell for 7 months of the year it's snowing and there's nothing else to do? Exactly. It's not an entirely unfair characterization of Cornell. But the 3 months, it's not. It's beautiful. It really is. I think if I could, all right, I would like to encapsulate, I'd like to paraphrase that question. If it doesn't get to the heart of that question, please let me know. But, you know, how has science motivated you to think about your faith, right? How was it involved in leading you to faith? And maybe even afterwards, how does it impact your faith? To be very honest with you, I cannot recall that science really led me to faith. Okay, I think what was really, really powerful for me is what I talked about today, and that is properly understanding what science is and what it isn't. In the same way that I strove hard to understand what the Bible is intended to be and what it isn't. And having clear understanding of that was incredibly important to me to lay out whether I even had any intellectual reasoning for pursuing faith. Right? And so that was probably the way in which science was most impactful for me, is in defining what the purview of science is. Right? And in having done that, I said, well, look, science doesn't constrain me only to it. It's not the sole arbiter of faith. And Blaise Pascal actually has some beautiful quotes on these things. There are many other ways of knowing. And our everyday human experiences teaches us that, right? But that's probably the most instrumental way in which science impacted me coming to faith. Nothing direct, actually just defining what it is well for myself, right? Subsequent to that, as a believer, doing science, right? How does science impact my faith? My faith, you know, doesn't come to play in the way that I do science, right? So I'm there to be a scientist and to be an excellent scientist, and that means that empiricism reigns, right? So I generate data, I do my best interpretation of that data, I generate subsequent hypotheses, then I go and test those hypotheses, right? And I may be generating diverse kinds of data, and so I'm making inferences from all of that, right? But that is my job as a scientist, whether I have a faith-based worldview or not. God has called me to science, I want to be an excellent scientist, so it's my job to be empirical, okay? However, when I do discover something ever so small about the way, let's say, our bodies work, or the tumor microenvironment, let's say, right, it is an opportunity for me to worship. Because it may be incredibly small, but I am ever so closer to understanding the mind of God. Right? And it's extremely humbling, because we think we know so much, we're in the most advanced age. The pace of data generation and the pace of technological advancement is just greater than we could have ever even imagined, right? And yet, we almost know nothing. We don't even know very basic things about how genes in the different cells of our body are controlled. We still don't know all the mechanisms that control that, right? Perhaps even most. And to this day, I mean, every couple of years, we'll find out a whole other layer of regulation of genes. And so it's incredibly humbling to me that we live in this incredible age of technology and advancement and scientific knowledge, and we are just scratching at the surface of what there is to know. So that, combined with the fact that it's an opportunity for me to worship when I discover something, even, you know, if it's fairly small in the scheme of things for God anyway, right? It's an opportunity to worship, right? Because I'm it gives me a chance to say, oh, cool. That's pretty neat, Doug. Right? That's a lot of toil that gets to that moment, right? And so it's a sweet moment. Yes?
As someone who has taken the time to explore all these religions and belief systems, why was it important to you to pick one to identify?
Yep. Question is, as someone who took the time to explore a lot of different faith traditions, why was it important to you to pick one to identify with? It wasn't actually important to me. To be very, very straightforward with you, I was sort of hoping that at the end of this, I'd be able to say, you know what? Let's all be a big happy family on this, right? It's all, everybody, every culture has, its approach, right? And to some extent, I still think that. I mean, I don't view other faith traditions with an us versus them mentality. I just don't. And maybe that's partially because I come from another faith tradition, right? And I know what honor seekers in that tradition are like, right? And so I don't have an us versus them mentality about it. I have a very much of a, gosh, we're all in this together. We are all trying to understand who made us, right? We're all trying to understand something bigger than ourselves. And there were, I think, genuine, honest attempts to try to get at that, right? And so in a way, the way that I think about other faiths is that there are a lot of interesting nuggets there. I mean, the golden rule is not a uniquely biblical principle. It's a lot of different faith traditions. What's different is Jesus. Mm-hmm. That he is the way and the truth and the life is what's different. Right? And so I think about it as those traditions may be missing something, right? As opposed to being entirely off base about everything, right? And somehow against us. I just don't have that view. And so, to get back to the question, I didn't set out to pick one. And I was secretly hoping that I wouldn't have to. Right? Particularly when I was reading the verses that said, this is going to cost you a lot to be my disciple. I was like, oh gosh, I really hope I don't have to. Right? It's not an unnatural reaction. But I was compelled to, right, as I studied it more. Yes?
Scriptures on several religions, and it's a little bit like looking at several series trying to explain one problem, and you, based on your logic, you figure out that if there is one that works very well to explain the problem. So you basically describe your conversion process like a logic. You figure out, oh, this theory works really well to explain a lot of things,
uh-huh.
And I'm convinced it's a little bit like that. But do you have other things beyond logical reasoning?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Please go ahead. Yeah, so the question is, you describe a lot of your logic and reasoning behind what led you to faith in Christ. Is there anything beyond your logic? Necessarily so, right? I mean, it's like, maybe the analogy that I can give is the love I have for my wife, okay? In the beginning, this is something we all do, right? When we're dating, we're looking for pieces of data. It's really what we're doing, like is she really into me? Is she not? Like, what's, you're trying to gauge the situation, right? And so that in a way, there's logic there, right? Like, you're trying to put together some of the pieces and get a sense for whether there's something here, right? But what happens? Is it like, do you prove it at the end? Right? Is there a proof? Right? There's no proof, right? And you never prove it. If you challenged me now to prove that my wife loves me, I'd be the first one to throw my hands up. I can't prove it to you. But maybe what I would do is tell you about a lot of different anecdotes or, give you a sense for our life together or, these kinds of things. And then there would have to be at some point, there would be a logic and a reason, but there'd have to be some kind of emotional resonance with it. Otherwise, I mean, that's just an unavoidable aspect of our humanity. And we seem to be okay with that in most parts of life, right? And we somehow have a hang-up with that when it comes to our relationship with the Lord. Right? And I think part of it is because we overemphasize the value of logic and reason. And this is someone who regards logic and reason very, very highly. But I think everything has its place. And so it definitely was not just a series of logical steps, I think the series of logical steps were absolutely critical for me in terms of bringing me to the point where I could more openly consider the possibility. Because, to be honest with you, I wasn't even sure that I liked the idea that there was a God who did all sorts of things I didn't like in the world, right? And so, you know, I didn't have a preset notion of where I would land. And I also, you know, was not even of the view that I would find any of these compelling. So I think what the logic led me to is a place where I could more honestly say, wow, okay, I need to explore this now with the totality of my being and not just my brain. And there has to be a step of faith. There has to be a step of faith. The same way I decided, I'm going to propose. I'm going to do this. There has to be a step of faith. And I took that step of faith. But once you've taken it, it's this dance for the rest of the time, right? It's this relationship. And it's this ins and outs, just like any other relationship. You have peaks and valleys, right, where you're closer to the Lord and not as close to the Lord. But it's the depth of that relationship over the course of the last 15 years that's now brought me to the point where I would say, no, I don't really doubt this anymore, right? Because this has been cemented in me, not just through logic and reason, which can be fallible and which have limitations, but through the depth of my human experience over the course of the last decade and a half. Yes, Audrey.
So one of the things that you said was how what was unique about Christianity is Christ as the prophetic hero of the Christian story in some way. And what really struck me when you were talking about his death was that Christ did two things that I think are interesting. One, I think he knew what he wants all of us to know, which is that death is not the end of the story, or that physical death is not necessarily the end. And secondly, he knew as God that he was going to come back to life. So I guess my question is that knowledge of what Christ knew challenged the notion that it was an act of sacrificial love, and does it actually matter?
Great question. So Audrey is a professor, so she projects well. So you probably did hear that question, but I'll repeat it. You didn't, okay, I'll repeat it anyway. So she said that, you know, one of the things that you mentioned in your talk is that you know, Jesus as the kind of pathetic hero on the cross type thing, right? But does the knowledge of the fact that Jesus knew he was going to be resurrected, right? And the fact that if you read on just another chapter or so, you find out that he is resurrected, how did that change, if at all, your perception of him as a pathetic figure dying on the cross? I'll answer that in a couple of different ways. One is, when I was reading through the gospel accounts, I didn't actually get to that part until like the third or fourth time through, because to be honest, I couldn't get past the cross. So that might have helped a little bit, okay? The fact that I didn't actually get there, okay? And I knew so precious little about the story that I wouldn't have been really tainted or biased otherwise. I mean, maybe I had some ideas, but nothing very specific. But by the time I did get there, okay, it didn't really impact the way that I thought about who this figure was and the way that he was being portrayed. Because by that point, what I was beginning to appreciate is that while, yes, he knew that he would be resurrected, right? Even for myself, I don't know that I want to go through that, right? Even if I knew that there was some kind of glory on the other side, right? And so his willingness, and then it's not just the resurrection, but it is this, the equality with God was nothing to be grasped by him. Right, that he would come down in the form of a human and walk our sod, right, and claim to be the creator of the world, right. It was really that at the end of the day that blew my mind away, right, and that he would be willing to be treated this way, and that it was really his plan all along to subject himself to this because he knew what needed to be done for us to be saved, right, and that yes, it is about Christ's glory, but it is ultimately that we can revel in it. That he did that for us, right? And so it didn't really change it for me, but I think it's a fantastic question. Yes?
Can you share your findings about the resurrection?
I'm sorry?
Can you share your findings about the resurrection?
Oh, so can you share your findings about the resurrection, which I so deftly left and went to another part of the talk? And I believe you're referring to when I said, oh, you know, I also studied features of the biblical accounts of the resurrection to try to give myself a sense for whether I believed it or not, right? There are quite a number, okay? And one of the reasons why I don't mention specifically is because I feel like I do it a disservice when I only have time to mention one or two. Because it's pretty easy to respond to one or two by going, all right, you know, whoop-de-doo, right? It was really the accumulation of many different kinds of features, but I will mention a couple, okay? One, I was really struck by how women were portrayed in the resurrection account, all right? This is a culture that fairly pejorative toward women, right? There, the witness of a woman was not admissible in court. That's the culture we're talking about right now, okay? And yet, it is women that first see the empty tomb. It is women that first get to proclaim the risen Lord, right? Well, they first that see the risen Lord, okay? And then the first that get to proclaim the risen Lord. Those three really, really blew me away, having had some understanding of the place of women in that particular culture, okay? Right off the bat for me, if I wanted to make up a story that I wanted everybody to believe, and women aren't admissible even in court, okay, in terms of their witness, I'm not gonna make up a story where women are the ones that are discovering everything, right? And the people writing this are fairly dim-witted, right? They don't get what's happening. Even after the resurrection, they're kind of scared and confused and hiding in a room, right? and it's the women that are discovering these things and proclaiming these things, right? And so even just that one was extremely fascinating to me, right? I mean, it was very hard to, and with more and more of those kinds of features of the story, it was just harder and harder to chalk this up to some kind of really creative story that someone came up with to try to convince people. If you wanted to convince people, that was a really, really bad way to do it, right? And yet, the growth of the early church was absolutely exponential, right? And you've got hundreds of people seeing the risen Lord, right? And so then you start to think about, well, you go through the classic options. Everybody had a hallucination, right? But you have different pockets of people in different periods of time, all having the same hallucination. Or, you know, maybe it's not that. Maybe those were all made up, right? And that that was Christian interpolation too, right? So I was trying to be open to all the different possibilities, but as the more and more of these kinds of features opened themselves up to me, it was harder and harder to hold the position that this could have just been fabricated by some creative minds, right? Because, you know, at the end of the day, if I'm going to make up a story that I want people to buy into, right? I mean, why do we resonate with our Supermans and our Batmans and our Spiders? These are superheroes, these demigods that, like, we concoct these things because we like them. It makes sense to us, right? And it's what you see in a lot of other faith traditions, too, right? I mean, I was used to thinking about, like, Hanuman or Krishna or someone in Hinduism. They're challenged or threatened, and there are some stories out there where they'll become 60 feet tall and scare them away. And I'm like, yeah, I can see me writing that. It makes kind of sense to me in terms of what I would concoct, right? This was a story that I just couldn't, as I got more and more of the features and internalized it, I couldn't embrace that view. It was harder and harder to do it intellectually. Yes?
After you made the decision to follow Christ, did you find it hard to like jump back into a community where people weren't as open to Christianity, or was it a natural kind of transition or step back into science?
Well, you know, I was an undergrad, so it wasn't so much like immersing myself in the scientific community again. In fact, it was actually kind of the opposite. I had this really long, rigorous, you know, intellectually satisfying journey of coming to faith, and I think I was really tired. Because at the end of it, when, you know, I became a Christian, I joined an evangelical community, right? And the reason why I say I think I was tired is because they just gave me this lens through which to see the world. Right? And it was sort of like, okay, now that I'm a Christian, I'm in this sort of happy club family, and if I have questions on things, I look through these glasses and I figure out what the answer is. Right? That was a great disservice to me, and I don't say this to malign the people that were involved in helping me convert to Christ, actually. I'm so greatly indebted to them, and I love them dearly. But I think there were some things that were done that maybe weren't the most helpful for me. Right? And I think I was eager to do it because I just wanted to fit in at that point. Right, and say, this was my new community, right? So it was actually a little bit the opposite. It wasn't so much going back into the scientific community as much as it was finding a new faith-based community, and then slowly unraveling myself a little bit and saying, let me just think through some of these things, right? Because I'm realizing I'm just kind of parroting a lot of spoon-fed talking points. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong, but I haven't even really thought about it myself. And God is challenging me to love him with a sound mind. You know, when the Holy Spirit grabbed me about that, I was in first year in graduate school at Penn, and he said, it's not so much that I think you're right or wrong about these issues that you're all up in arms about, okay? But it's that I don't really think you're doing it because you love me, right? And I wasn't, right? And so that was another very critical juncture point for me in terms of how I related with the evangelical community, which was mine, you know? But I needed to do the work, needed to do some more work to figure out how I related with that community and what my role in that community was going to be.
How do you explain the discrepancies between the gospel, like Matthew, Mark, and like the two different accounts of the same thing, and it's very different? So like, how do you explain the discrepancies?
Yeah, so the question is, how do you explain discrepancies in the gospel accounts, right? And presumably, how does that affect your interpretation or your willingness to believe in the gospel accounts? I think this is also like the problem of evil question. Is a massive question that a lot has been written about for decades, right? And so I'm certainly not going to cover all of it here, but the reason why I like the question is because it was one that really was important to me when I was doing a lot of these kinds of examinations of the historicity. Are these accounts even reliable? What are the standard ways in which you, you know, deal with a historic text? One of the things I found is that, you know, that if the gospel accounts were more concordant than they appear to be to us, I think that would be a problem to us. We'd say, well, wait a minute, it's not really possible that these guys writing at different times wrote about the same exact thing in the same exact way, right? There's clearly some kind of, you know, cheating going on here, right? But then when they are apparently discordant, we get upset about that too, right? And so I think there's a lose-lose situation here. Actually, because no matter how it appeared to us, I think we'd find ways to have problems with it. So I think that's the first thing that I began to appreciate. That doesn't mean that it's not still a valid question. So the second, you know, the point here is to make is many of those, not necessarily all, okay, but many of those are not as discrepant as it may actually appear. So the vast majority of those, at least the ones that I'm familiar with and that I've researched, are the kinds of things that you could get differently, any two people standing in different positions of the oval looking at the memorial church will see slightly different things, right? In the paintings on the church, for example, right? And so you may describe a part of it, and I think so a lot of it that has, that the answer that's been given is that each of these accounts reflects a part of the account. It's not intended to be holistic. And historical accounts of all sorts of other things are rarely ever holistic anyway, right? And we usually don't have a problem with those. So sometimes I do feel like we are applying a certain standard to the Bible as a historical text that we don't often apply to really any other texts that are out there. So there may be some unfairness there that we need to be cautious of as well. Finally, there are some that over the course of time seem to get resolved. There's this one apparent discrepancy about how one gospel account says that Jesus was going toward Jericho and another one says he was coming from Jericho when the same event happened. I think it might have been healing of a blind man. But it turns out that there's archaeological evidence that there may, in fact, have been two Jerichos. Right? So I don't get, the point is that I don't really get too caught up in these things anymore, right? Unless that there's something that really gets to the heart of the Christian message about who Jesus is and what he did for us, right? If there's a discrepancy there, I think we ought to talk about it. But I don't see one.
I think that leads to our last question for 6 times. Will you be hanging around a little bit after the meeting to ask you one-on-one?
I will be, a few minutes. My little boy is waiting for me to be put to bed, so as much as I love you guys, he's my top priority. But yes, I love your questions and all.
Privilege of asking questions. And if you can come back up. As I said, we will close with one last song. I'll let you guys and Dr. Sentapati.